This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Remember normal? You grew up in a world with fractures and tensions, sure, but overall there were rules and agreements spanning human settlements. Power in the world order seems to be shifting again, but this time the long history of empires and geopolitics is hitting a wall. It is not just the COVID attack from the micro world. According to scientists, all species could be approaching the possibility of mass extinction as the world heats up. Alfred W. McCoy is the Harrington Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is author of more than a dozen books, including In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. But Professor McCoy's latest book adds climate change to the usual games of human power. The title is To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. From Madison, Wisconsin, Alfred McCoy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Are you still sure American global power is declining?
Oh, I think there's every sign of it. By the end of this decade, by 2030, there are going to be a couple of major shifts that I think indicate the eclipse of U.S. global power, the end of U.S. hegemony, which has existed since 1945, the end of World War II. Most fundamentally, the economic foundations for global power, which are the basis of any empire over the past 500 years, are shifting markedly in favor of China. The international accounting firm PricewaterhouseCoopers projects that by 2030, China's economy will be at $38 trillion, and it'll be about 40 to 50% larger than the size of the U.S. economy. And that gives China just enormous power in the global stage. Second, since China and the United States spend over the long term about 2 and 3% of their gross domestic product on defense, that means that by 2030, China's military will no longer be a near-peer competitor, to use the Pentagon's phrasing, but an actual peer competitor with the United States. And there are already signs that China is ahead of the United States in a number of critical areas that make a difference, not just the massive throwaweight of tanks and trucks and ships and planes, but the strategic technological edge that determines the outcome of battles in the modern world. Specifically, the Chinese have launched successfully a hypersonic missile. Those are missiles that fly in excess of 4,000 miles an hour. There is no American defense for such a missile. And if launched, that means that a U.S. aircraft carrier off the coast of China, maneuvering in the great power politics, such as those aircraft carriers do, it can be basically eliminated. We may have bigger aircraft carriers than China right now, and that means that simply we have bigger targets. And then there's the security of satellite communications, which are a critical domain of contestation. You know, basically all the three C's of command, control, and communication of U.S. military forces globally go by satellites. China's satellites are much more secure in terms of their communications. Our satellites can be either hacked or shot out of the skies in the event of a conflict. So in all kinds of arenas in the military domain, China is catching up and is likely to be superior in 2030. And that means if the contest comes to a fight, and it may, it's likely to occur in that critical geopolitical flashpoint between the China coast and the Pacific littoral, running from Japan through the Ryukyus, Okinawa, Taiwan, the Philippines, all the way down to Australia. That's what the Chinese call the first island chain. So it's in that sort of 200-mile span of water. At best, let's say if we have two U.S. supercarriers, we've got 150 jets that we can deploy in such a contest. Because it's close to China, China has in excess of 2,000 combat aircraft that they can deploy. Plus, they have something called the carrier killer missile, which the U.S. Navy regards as a major threat to its ships. And so when the Pentagon, a couple years ago, did a war game, had run a series of war games about war between China and the United States over Taiwan in the Taiwan Straits, China won 18 out of the 18 war games. So even the Pentagon knows that a war where it's most likely to occur with China, we're going to lose. So that means basically, in terms of the substrate of economic power and the potential for military conflict, China will be dominant by 2030.
In your new book, To Govern the Globe, you suggest the turning point for China's ascendancy is the Belt and Road Project. It's strange how many people in North America don't know about that. How would you explain it?
It's the largest development project in human history. Many people would be familiar with the Marshall Plan. After World War II in 1948, the United States voted a very generous program that provided about $13 billion for the redevelopment of Europe. In Europe, about 30% of all housing stock was destroyed. The Allied bombing of Germany had just devastated the cities of Germany. The continent was cold and hungry and at the edge of starvation in many areas. And the United States came through with the Marshall Plan that rebuilt a ravaged Europe. And the prosperous European Union we see today is in many ways attributable to this generous aid program. Well, if we correct it for inflation, it's about $100 billion. The Belt and Road Initiative is projected to be $1.2 trillion. In other words, it's 12 times larger than the Marshall Plan. And instead of being directed at just one continent, Europe, in fact, the Belt and Road Initiative is directed at three continents. First of all, China is laying down and has largely completed a transcontinental infrastructure of gas pipelines that's now being followed with transcontinental rail lines that are the construction expansion of that is ongoing. They're extending similar infrastructure efforts to Africa, which China has long treated as a global development partner. They've been active in aid programs in China since the early 1970s, major aid programs, targeted infrastructure, the Tanzan Railroad, for example, that now crosses the breadth of Africa. So the combination of this massive program of $1.3 trillion is going to do two things. First of all, it's going to integrate the whole of the vast Eurasian landmass into a unitary infrastructure and market. And since Beijing is building that infrastructure, the products and profits are going to flow as if by natural law towards Beijing. And Eurasia is the home of 70% of the world's population and 70% of its productivity. So dominating Eurasia is tantamount to dominating the global economy, indeed the globe. Moreover, as Africa's population and human potential grows, China is in on the ground floor. Massive infrastructure projects, you know, complex but effective collaborative relationships. We in the United States tend to regard Africa as kind of a charity case. You know, the Gates Foundation worries about public health. It's all very nice, but we're treating Africa historically as much as we treated. During the Cold War, we treated it like a battleground. Now we're treating it as kind of like the charity case. China treats Africa as very much as a serious economic partner for the building of a global economy in the 21st century. And together they're fusing these three continents into something that the father of modern geopolitics, Sir Halford Mackinder, back in 1904, called the World Island. And he said in one of his many famous axioms about geopolitics, he said, and basically, heartland controls Eurasia, and he who controls Eurasia controls the world. And that geopolitical truism remains true today. And China is maneuvering through the Belt and Road Project to dominate Eurasia. Moreover, as a part of this project, not only have they laid down that kind of grid, that steel grid of roads and rails and gas pipelines across the continent from the Atlantic to the Pacific, across the span of 6,000 miles, but they've also ringed the coast of Eurasia and Africa with a string of 40 ports, commercial ports, that China either is built wholly or is redeveloping with its own capital. And the combination of the rail grid across the continent and the ports ringing the Eurasian and African world island landmass places China in the position of basically dominating Eurasia. And you have to understand, okay, historically, for the past 500 years, this is something that I actually learned in writing this book, To Govern the Globe, starting with Portugal, Spain, Holland, Britain, the United States, and now China. Over the span of 500 years, the span of centuries, these very diverse succession of imperial powers have one thing in common, that their rise to global power has been synonymous with their dominance over the Eurasian landmass, and their decline has been simultaneous with their loss of control over the Eurasian landmass. Okay, so at the very start of the Cold War, the United States became the first power in human history to build an empire without peer on the planet, and its geopolitical foundations lay through its capacity to control what we might call the axial ends of Eurasia. Through the NATO alliance in Europe, they got massive air, land, and sea bases that gave it dominance over that end. And through four bilateral mutual defense pacts with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Australia, the United States was able to build a string of military and naval bastions down that chain of islands that formed the Pacific littoral. And through this strategy, the United States had control of the axial ends of Eurasia, and then it linked them with bands of steel, a series of military alliances from NATO to CENTO to CETO to the ANZUS alliance with Australia and New Zealand. And then it built two massive fleets, the Sixth Fleet in the Atlantic and Mediterranean, the Seventh Fleet in the Pacific and Indian Ocean. To that, they eventually added the Fifth Fleet in the Persian Gulf, and hundreds of military bases ringing Eurasia. And, you know, for 70 years, the United States has exercised its dominion over Eurasia and thus laid the geopolitical foundations for its global power. And we've been on top for so long that we've forgotten the geopolitical foundations and fundamentals of our power. And now it's being challenged. You can, you know, scamper right round through the news clips and look at the eruption of flashpoints around Eurasia, which the media treats quite responsibly as individual cases. But when you add them up, when you connect the transcontinental dots, what you're looking at is nothing less than the ongoing erosion of U.S. control over Eurasia, and thus the eclipse of its global power.
In your own words in Tom's dispatch, you ask the question, what does it take to destroy a world order? And this applies, I think, to our study of climate change as well, because you seem to say that a world order has its inertia, it wants to keep going, but it takes something really big to knock it off.
First of all, let me very quickly define the difference between an empire and a world order, because world order is used loosely. I use it in a very specific sense, okay? Empires are hard physical domains defended by armies, often have boundaries, so they're palpable, they're physical, all right? World orders are far less palpable, but they're far more persistent and pervasive. Empires are all about territories and armies. World orders are about nothing less than human civilizations. World orders govern the languages people speak, the laws they observe, the way they work, worship, and even play, okay? This is known, I suppose, in contemporary parlance as soft power, but it's much more deeper and pervasive. So Washington did two things when it built its empire without peer on the planet at the end of World War II. It arrayed those military forces across Eurasia, as I just described. But the second thing it did, very importantly, was it built a world order, you know, that is embodied in the United Nations and literally hundreds of international organizations that are all grounded on two fundamental principles, universal human rights and the idea that all human beings are a part of national communities which have the right to inviolable sovereignty. So universal human rights and inviolable sovereignty. And as the U.S. global power fades around 2030, the big question is whether or not the world order, this liberal world order the United States has built, is also going to fade. And there's every sign that China has, first of all, little respect for the international rule of law that undergirds the U.S. world order, and second of all, has very little respect for the human rights, which are one of its fundamental principles. China's world order, as it emerges after 2030, is likely to be far more transactional, mutual advantage, without condition on government probity, performance, or integrity, or human rights. So it's going to be a different kind of a world order that emerges under China. And you mentioned climate change. Well, you know, so let's assume, you know, looking forward into the murky mists of the future, that U.S. power fades by 2030 and China ascends. That's not too surprising, okay? The question then is, how long will China's world order last? And China is literally digging its own grave. China is not only building a dynamic world economy, but it's also doing it on fossil fuels. China, as it announced at Glasgow earlier, is not even going to begin to introduce climate change reforms until its next five-year plan, which starts in 2025. So they won't even start till 2025. And China's committed itself to being carbon neutral by 2060. India has now committed itself to being carbon neutral by 2070. Well, at the rate we're going, that means that climate change is going to surge ahead, driven by China, which accounts for right now 30% of all greenhouse gas emissions. And China, with its own coal-based electrical system and its propagation of coal plants as part of the Belt and Road Initiative, means that these emissions are going to increase. So if you look at the environmental science, it's clear that by 2050, rising sea levels mean that Shanghai, which was dredged from swamp and sea starting in the 15th century, is going to sink back into the waters from whence it came. That means that the most economically dynamic city in China, home now to 18 million people, is going to be largely underwater. And the second thing that's going to happen, starting around 2070, but actually building in the decades before that, is the North China Plain is going to become one of the least habitable places on the planet. Now, the North China Plain, which is that part of China between Shanghai and Beijing, is currently home to about 400 million people, about a third of China's population. It's also a core agricultural and industrial region. It's in many ways China's heartland. And that by 2070, the North China Plain is, according to environmental projections, going to experience something called five incidents of 35 degrees centigrade wet bulb temperature. Now, what does that gobbledygook mean? All right, wet bulb temperature is the balance between heat and humidity. And when you get to 35 degrees wet bulb temperature, a healthy adult human being sitting at rest is dead within 6 hours because the body can't sweat. You're just dead. And so that means that China is going to go through this absolutely unimaginable series of heat waves. And apart from those crisis inflections of 35-degree wet bulb temperature, they're going to have hundreds of incidents of 31-degree wet bulb temperature, which is extremely dangerous, not death, but extremely dangerous for human beings exposed to this climate. So between the two, China is going to have to start around 2050 withdrawing from the world and the world order that it created. And that, of course, leads us to an opening. That means for the first time in five centuries, if not six centuries, we will have a world without a world order, and that creates the possibility of constructing a very different kind of world, which we can talk about a bit if you've got a chance.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are talking about the New World Order and climate change with well-known historian and author Alfred W. McCoy. I noticed that you are a scholar of Southeast Asia studies, yet you picked the Mediterranean basin as a starting point for climate force change. Why is that?
Because that's one of the regions of the globe, along with the Arctic, that's most likely to be adversely affected by climate change. Starting in about 2010, Syria had one of the worst droughts in the modern era that produced lots of social conflict and movement of population. That contributed very much to that civil war and the out-migration of hundreds of thousands of Syrians into Turkey and then across the Aegean into Europe and all the problems that ensued from that between 2016 and 2018. So that's kind of, one of the, if you will, along with the Arctic, one of the canaries in the coal mine. And because it's a densely inhabited portion of the globe, the consequences are such that we can see them. Between 2016 and 2018, there were three movements of population largely, or at least considerably, generated by climate change. There were the movements of people from the Middle East through Turkey into the Greek islands into Europe, Africans from sub-Saharan Africa crossing the Sahel and then crossing the Mediterranean into Europe, and then the movement of Central Americans, particularly Guatemalans, through Mexico to the southern border. And this movement of population produced an enormous backlash, the rise of very angry, very aggressive right-wing populism, evidenced across Europe. And in the United States, it contributed to Donald Trump's successful presidential campaign, his Build the Wall campaign slogan was kind of, you know, basically build the wall on the southern border of the United States to stop the illegal Central American migrants from entering the United States. So what was the source of all this ferment on the right, this rise of hypernationalism and the erosion of international cooperation between 2016 and 2018? You add it all up, it's just 2 million people, okay? By 2050, the projections by the World Bank, the UN, and everybody says that minimally, by 2050, there will be 200 million climate change refugees. And some estimates go as high as 1.2 billion. Okay? So if you can imagine all of the political backlash from just 2 million people, how is the world, without some kind of global order, going to deal with this global disorder of mass migrations of absolutely unprecedented in nature? Okay, and you know, I think that there are three possible reforms that we can do in the current international order to begin to turn global disorder with you know, unimaginable conflicts, water wars, ships being pushed out to sea with migrants to just sink beneath the waves. I mean, just, you know, horrors without beyond imagining, okay? So how do we turn global disorder into a alternative global order? Well, if we work from the current apparatus, the United Nations, there are three, I think, simple shifts of sovereignty, slender but significant, that could occur, that could begin to address this. First, the UN could consider carbon emissions to be a violation of sovereignty. When one nation emits into the atmosphere, that's violating the sovereignty of all other nations. And so there would be a ban and a requirement for carbon neutrality, okay, accelerated carbon neutrality. Second, that instead of the voluntary resettlement and all of its chaos that we see now, in which the UN High Commissioner of Refugees is struggling to adapt and accommodate these human flows, when they surge to these levels of 200 million or 1 billion, then we have a mandatory resettlement on the basis of accessible and usable resources. And third, a third cessation of national sovereignty would be that the voluntary capital transfers, supposed to be $100 billion, much discussed and debated at Paris first and then Glasgow at these UN climate conferences, and which haven't been fully paid, okay, that these transfers, instead of being voluntary, would become mandatory. Transfers of capital from the survivable, habitable, temperate zone to the troubled tropics, so that as maximum number of people would be spared the ordeals of migration and could shelter in place with capital support to adapt to climate change, which is possible. When you think about it, one of the things I learned about the study of world orders over the past 500 years, that as an essential part of their apparatus is the form of energy. In the Iberian Age, when Spain and Portugal were dominant from roughly 1500 to 1800, or at least their ethos was dominant, the form of energy was human muscle power. And so that was the nature of the slave trade, to maximize the energy output of the human body. And then in the British Imperial Age, which succeeded the Iberian Age, it was coal-fired energy, coal-fired steam power, that allowed the British Empire to, first of all, extirpate the slave trade, and second of all, transition to a non-muscle power-based order. And so we got the coal-fired energy and, of course, the emissions. In the American era, we went to a more efficient form of fossil fuel. We went to petroleum, right? And now what we're switching to is alternative energy. Now, if you think about the coincidence between the structure of global power and the energy apparatus that we have, what we've got is, you know, seven or so powerful oil major companies backed by the military might of the United States controlling the production and distribution of energy and all the politics that comes from that, okay? So it's a very steep hierarchy of corporate and military power. And potentially, what we're looking at is a diffusion of energy through renewable sources. It's possible with solar energy, you know, and we're going to have to fight our energy companies over this, that everybody, wherever the sun shines, would have their own solar panels and their own energy. So there would be a decentralized energy structure, much more democratic, that could complement this much more democratic international order at the United Nations, That would entail, for example, a simple reform of the Security Council, ending the permanent seats, and distributing seats on the Security Council on a much more democratic basis. So we could have a much more democratic international community grounded in a much more diffuse and decentralized energy system. And that gives me some hope of the possibilities of change and coping with the climate crisis circa 2050.
Professor McCoy, what are you working on next?
That's a very good question. What I'm working on next is actually trying to think through the implications of the book I just finished. What I just told you about the correspondence between the more democratic world order and the more diffuse and decentralized energy system, that's implicit in the model of my book, but I didn't quite articulate it fully and clearly enough. And so, you know, my step is I'm writing a series of articles for this online journal, Tom Dispatch, to get picked up by The Nation and, you know, get translated. My last essay was translated into German and Spanish within like 2 days. It's one of the things about the Internet. When you put something out there that's got market value, the market spreads it. So I'm writing these essays and trying to think through the implications of the model that I built in that book. Because it's proving, I think, and forgive me for saying this, objectively, to be a very useful model. And it's going to take me time to realize the possibilities of my own model through my own writings. My next article is going to be on what I just talked about here. I've been thinking this through. Okay, that balance between changing the United Nations to be more democratic and having this diffuse, decentralized system of community-based and household-based energy systems.
Well, for me, this is the first real application of climate science to the study of geopolitics that I've seen, and it's very, very informative. We've been speaking with Dr. Alfred McCoy, historian and professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His new book rewrites the history of the future during the climate crisis. Look for To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. You can find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Alfred, thank you for sharing your time and your insight.
Thank you very much for the conversation. This was a great conversation.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.